life weaves itself into our own rhythms, inviting us to move and participate with the Spirit of God. And I suggested that that Spirit of God and the human spirit longings, that there's a rhythm to it, that there's a discernible pulse that is involved. And I've got a crude diagram on the board, but that one movement of that life in the Spirit is us becoming rooted in and soaking in the womb-like grace of God, becoming immersed in that, deepening and becoming more and more grounded in that as one movement. A second movement of that life in the Spirit is becoming emboldened or empowered into the fullness of what it means to be a humanity fully alive. And the third impulse of that life is that life goes out into the rest of the world, stirred with compassion for the pain of the world and seeking to be an agent of reconciliation, of healing, and of justice. And that the pulse of God's Spirit and the pulse of the spiritual life really can be articulated in those three different rhythms, those three different currents. And that's kind of where we were. Is that the beginning sketch? And maybe I'll tell a quick story to kind of put some flesh on that, because we were also talking about story as an art form that has a unique ability to open up the dimensions of life in the Spirit, to help us access what that life is like and what its invitation is all about. And so I'd like to share a story that kind of puts some flesh on this. Ready for a story?
Yeah.
It's Thursday afternoon after lunch, and maybe we had a nap or maybe we didn't. So this is a story that my son gave me permission to share. He doesn't remember it very well. He was 7 months old when it happened. And we were visiting grandparents in St. Louis. And Justin was at that age, at 7 months, where he was just interested in taking in everything. And he would perch himself on a stroller and just gaze at the world, taking it all in, trying to understand what everything is going on in the midst of it. Well, we were visiting a mall, and the other persons were going in and out of the stores, and Justin and I, we weren't really shoppers, so we were just kind of strolling up and down the walkway in the middle of the stores, right? And we were people watching, and after a while, I got kind of tired, so I leaned up against a planter, and I was just sort of rocking Justin in the stroller back and forth, and he was just perched on the end of it, looking at everything and everybody. And as I'm sitting there, I notice off to my left in the distance, there's a woman coming towards us. She looked about retirement age, but what was noticeable about her was that she seemed to be the most closed, angry, tight person I could conceive of. She had her jaw clenched, her teeth were tight, her purse was clasped in one arm, a shopping bag in the other, and she was just marching down this walkway, right down towards us, in the midst of all the people, didn't care who was in her way, she was barging her way on a mission. I don't know if she was going to see some disgruntled shopping clerk or what was going on, but I did not want to be in her path, and neither did anybody else, as they're getting out of her way, because she is just moving down this walkway. Well, I'm just kind of wondering what's going on with her. What I didn't realize is that Justin was watching her too. Watching her move and twitch her body down this walkway. And as she got close to us, she was still in full stride. Her head was twitching back and forth. And as she got near us, she twitched off to the side and looked at Justin. And for a moment, their eyes locked. And Justin did the most incredible thing. He smiled. And when he smiled, I watched as all of the hardness of this woman simply melted away. She let out a sigh, got on her knees, put down her bags, and for the next several minutes, the two of them were absolutely lost in one another. She's tickling Justin underneath his arms. He's grabbing after her eyeglasses. The two of them are giggling and cooing, absolutely radiant. You'd think a light was coming down from heaven and just emboldening them in the moment of what it means to be human. Absolute, unadulterated, unconditional delight in the existence and beauty of another person. And after several minutes of the two of them washing each other in their smiles and their giggles, she noticed that I was there too. And she looked up at me and she said, "God bless him. God bless him. And God bless you too." She got up and she walked away. I had a teacher, Jim Loder, who told us that the paradigm, the very prototype of what it means to be human can be found in the loving gaze that occurs between an adult and an infant. Have you ever seen an adult and an infant like Justin and this person? That smile, that radiance, that mutual delight. He suggested that that is the picture, the snapshot, the imprint of what it means to be fully human when we are fully human. And in that moment, there's a pulsation. It bubbles with life. It bubbles with spirit. And what I want to suggest is that in that very snapshot, you can see these three pulses happening. There is the way in which this woman finds herself surprised by grace. A face coming into her world in the midst of her anger, her hardness, her busyness, and she finds herself held by the mystery of one whose smiling face gazes upon us whether we see it or recognize it or not. And in seeing that, in resting in it, in orienting ourselves to it, an emboldening happens. An empowerment happens as she is lifted up on eagle's wings almost, radiant and alive in what it looks like to be human. Not only her, but Justin too. Fully alive, fully shining in the radiance of what it means to be a human being in relationship. But the life is so much. The bubbling and spirit is so full, it cannot be contained in the moment. It absolutely has to spill itself out so that when she looks at the person who is near the circle, she has to say, "And God bless you too." And she goes walking down the hallway, "And God bless you too. And God bless everyone," on Christmas Eve. Do you see that sort of centering and reorienting, and then that emboldening and empowerment, and then going out into the world as an agent of the very grace that you have been touched by? That moment, it pulsates with that rhythm for me. What does it mean to be a humanity fully alive? I think it must look something like that. What do you think? That makes sense? So what I'd like for us to play around with a little bit is to focus today more on this second movement and see what can we discern from the various stories that we can all imagine and articulate about what we do look like when we are fully human and fully alive. One of my favorite lines by a theologian comes from one of the early church theologians, St. Irenaeus, where he said simply, "The glory of God is humanity fully alive." God is glorified when we are fully alive. I think in our culture today, we need to hear that. I think as Christians, we often carry an assumption within us that the glory of God is really a humanity denigrated. That God really wants to enslave us. That God really wants to conquer our will. God really wants us to become obedient and submissive before God. And that all of those impulses within us, those yearnings for life and joy and happiness and all of the ways in which we experience those in relationships and physically and in our work, that God doesn't really want us to be that bubbly and alive. But if Irenaeus is right, God does not only yearn for our life, God's self is glorified. God shines more fully. God is more radiant when humanity is fully alive. God's glory in humanity being human. Does that make sense? I had a friend who was a dance therapist, and she would work with persons who needed some physical therapy to work through operations on limbs, and persons who were physically challenged, and she would use movement and dance as a way of working through and healing and bringing therapy, emotionally and physically. And she told me once about a wedding reception that she had attended. She was at the reception, and she was in this big hall, and there were all these round tables with people sitting all around them. And up at the front of the hall, there was this dance ensemble and a little tiny dance floor. And while everybody was kind of chatting with one another around the tables, the music of the wedding would be playing by this ensemble. And the invitation was for anyone who would like to come and dance that they might join themselves on the dance floor and rest in the music of the wedding. She was sitting there talking with some friends when she noticed up towards the front was this older gentleman in a wheelchair trying to worm his way through the crowded tables, and she watched as he made his way all the way up to the dance floor. And once he got there, he simply leaned back in his wheelchair and started to rock to the music. And on an impulse, she decided to get up and walk up to this total stranger, and she bent down to him and she said, "Excuse me, sir, but could I share this dance with you?" And this smile of delight came across his face as he said, "Why, miss, I'd be delighted." And for the next several minutes, the two of them, hand in hand, hand on chair, simply rocked and rolled and twirled and swayed their way up and down the dance floor. People were so caught up by it that they just gave way and all watched as the two of them simply danced as one to the music of the wedding feast. And when it was all over, the two of them sat down at a table to chat and get acquainted. And the gentleman said to her, "Thank you so much for dancing with me. You know, I haven't danced in probably 20 years. I used to be a dancer. And oh, how I miss it. When I dance, I feel alive. When I dance, I feel the very power of God lifting me up into love." I think there's another snapshot of what it looks like when we are fully alive, when we are fully human. Being human is like finding ourselves in relationship with another in such a unique way that it's as if we are joined together and held aloft by a spirit that swells within us, bringing us into life. And one of the unique things about that dancing relationship is that two things are happening simultaneously. On the one hand, we find ourselves being utterly individual, utterly unique, utterly at the height of our own unique powers, our own distinctiveness, being lifted up. I never feel more fully alive than when I am dancing as an individual. You see that in that personal power sort of swelling up within one in the midst of the dance. You see that? But that does not happen by yourself. It happens in relationship with another person, a relationship that is so connected, so moving as one, that it is almost as if the two of you are united, are one, fully relational, fully connected, fully moving in step with one another. The paradox of being both fully individual and fully in relationship is the paradox of being human. Does that make sense? That's a hard thing to live in. Often we find ourselves needing to demand our individuality over and against our relationality, trying to protect our own personal space, defining ourselves as pillars of strength and a tower, a pillar in the community, right? See this long, lone individual, or a tower of strength. You know, I need my space. I am an individual. And relationships threaten that, right? Don't get too close. I need to hang on to my individuality. And then there are persons who more define themselves by their relationships, who might even lose themselves in their relationships instead of losing themselves in individuality, who might describe themselves as being a web of connectedness instead of a pillar of the community. Needs more together time, not more space. The problem is they usually marry each other. The dance becomes a tug of war, and the fight for space is felt as a threat to my need for connectedness, and that trying to grasp connectedness is a threat to my individuality, and so we begin to vie off of one another instead of finding ourselves united and individual at the same time, held by a spirit. And yet we've all experienced those times in which we are at the height of our own individual powers and yet fully connected with others as well. Does that make sense? Guys, women, you experience it in sports, do we not? When you're part of a team and we feel completely at one and yet at the height of our own powers, or singing in a choir, or in playing music, right? Or when we're engaged in a service project with a group of people and we get so jazzed by the work that we're doing that it's like we are a community, we are one, and yet our own individual giftedness is part of that and valued and respectedness. Part of what it means to be a humanity fully alive, I think, is living in that tension. And the way in which we find that is as we are held by a spirit, the Spirit of God, that unites and uplifts at the same time. Amen. So what do you think? I mean, is that...
It's interesting, your second example there with the wedding dance, it seems like also some of that life energy was transmitted to those other folks, particularly on the dance floor who were watching, now with us, the folks sitting at the tables too.
It spills out. Mm-hmm. It spills out. It cannot be contained in the container, right? That when we are experiencing that life, we feel that impulse within us that want to include everybody and to be gracious towards other people and to try to bring them into it. And we feel attracted to that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like when the kids were dancing at Vespers.
Absolutely, yes, right. The kids just kind of getting up there and dancing, and we feel ourselves connected, and maybe want to dance up there with them too if we weren't so self-conscious. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, John Powell had a book, Fully Human, Fully Alive.
Yeah, I'm not, yeah. I know John Powell, but yeah, I don't know that book.
That was one of his many, many books. Huh. And what you're saying is a lot like he said. And one of the things that humans many times that we don't want to get mad, we don't want to get angry. He's talking about emotions, and you've got to have emotions.
Absolutely.
You've got to have happiness and joy and sadness and laughter and tears and everything else if you're going to be a human.
Yeah, that is the guts of life. That's the guts of life. It's all of that, all of it. And being at home in it and willing to experience it and experience that with another. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
think it was interesting that you mentioned at the beginning the child as the means of creating some kind of experience. That, because that's I had a child, he's now a year and a half, but when he was pre-yelling and sweet like Justy, smiling, everybody would be our friend. I think people who have dogs have the same thing. If you take them out to the park, people start talking. But if you're just in the grocery store by yourself, everybody's like, But if you're carrying the child, it's like, oh,
we'll
start talking to you. And
Something
will come out of that.
Yeah, there's something about that. There's something about that, yeah. But also, there's something about it for the child. I mean, think of it as an infant. You know, if your first interaction with the human community are people who come up to you and smile and giggle at you and give you delight, I mean, what a deep imprint of trust and affirmation and acceptance that forms the bedrock by which we are able to maneuver in the world. What happens to that? Where do we stop doing that for one another? We are undercutting the very foundation for us to be empowered into what it means to be human when we stop doing that for one another.
My comment was that it seems to me that many of us try to jump to that third point you have there of trying to be of service. And unless you have that grounding in the, you know, the first two, that can be very deadening and draining.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I'm glad you also said it, because this is not like one, two, three. This is a rhythm.
Right.
You know, and as you go out and serve and participate, we're experiencing the draining, and we experience the frustration and the despair and anything else. And so we come back to the center. We come back to the face. We come back to worship. We come back to the foundation, the vision behind it all. And we are renewed and restored so that we can go back into the world. And it is a rhythm. It moves backwards and forwards. It pulsates around and around and around.
Yeah. I'd like to hear her. I don't know who that is up there. For you to say a little bit more about what you just said.
I think the play that was put on the other night about the man who tried to be good all the time and tried to join all the right things and do everything well. I think some of us just jump right into that and think that, you know, that's my duty, that's how I was raised, that's what I should be doing. But we don't have that grounding and joy to keep filling us up again so that life can be joyful.
I think sometimes it also involves opening yourself up to being more vulnerable. And I'm thinking of a situation, something like you were saying, where my brother was, and maybe you had this experience, sitting on a runway for 3 long hours waiting for your turn to take off, some kind of problem, and the plane is silent and people are starting to get restless. And it happened to be during the Christmas season, so he stood up. And he started to sing Jingle Bells. And everybody on the plane started to sing Jingle Bells. And it was a matter of, you know, here's this guy in a suit who's going to stand up and start singing and just wait to see what happens. And everybody joined in, and it was the most wonderful.
Absolutely. But it takes someone willing to be vulnerable and to open that up and take that first step and naming the frustration, or naming the longing to be home and not on the plane that was experienced by all, that the song together helps us to connect around and all of that. Yeah, absolutely. Makes great sense to me.
I love that image of that push-pull kind of image of being individual and in the relationship, that process, that tension. And I think about vulnerability, and with that I also think about how we most want intimacy and yet we're most afraid of intimacy as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think we all live in the struggle of that. We find ourselves at different ends of that at different times in our lives, threatened in different ways. Well, what I'd like to suggest is that is that God is a spirit of that dance in the midst of creation, is woven through creation, yearning for us to know that fullness of life that we are talking about. And that each one of us, I suspect each of us, have tasted glimpses of that at different times in our lives, times in which we found ourselves being fully alive. You know, in this moment, when I'm doing this activity or I'm spending time with this person, I feel like I'm at the height of my powers. I feel like this is me in all of my uniqueness and giftedness. This is when I am most alive. And that in those moments, we experience the swelling of that spirit that yearns for us to be in that kind of a life ever more fully. I suggest that spirit is in our midst, inviting us to recognize ourselves as those persons fully alive and inviting us to step into their lives, into that life. And I also suggest that we, as the community, have a unique role in helping one another step into the life that is our own. That one of the things we do in community is that we recognize what the fullness of life, what the unique giftedness is within each other. And we call that into being. We help a person step into and become who they are when they are most truly who they are. Help us to be able to discover our own unique giftedness. And when we do that for one another, we are participants in that spirit that helps us step into that precise kind of life. Am I making sense? So let me tell a story. Justin, I'm telling the story now. Okay. Justin and I have a deal that I had to tell this story sometime on the trip, so I'm surprised he's leaving the room. It's his favorite story that I tell. When I was a kid, I wanted to grow up and become a football star just like my dad. You want a better seat, is that it? I wanted to be just like my dad. Now, my dad was a construction worker, and so his glory days of football stardom had long since passed. But I remember the way in which he would come alive in the garage. He'd be heaving a saw through a 2x4 or raking his way through a toolbox trying to get a crescent wrench and cussing away when the radio would be playing and the sounds of the upcoming 49er game would start to work their way in the garage. The band would start to play. You would hear the cheerleaders cheering. Some announcer would be marking off yard lines as Jerry Rice was scoring a touchdown. And my dad would stop. And he would gaze out the garage door as if he was carried away by those sounds on wings. And then he would look at me and say, "Did I ever tell you about the championship game when I was a senior in high school?" "No, Dad. Tell me." "It was the fourth quarter. We were down by 6. We had been down by 18 just a few minutes before, but we were fighting back. And we had the ball, 8 seconds left, on the 8-yard line, 92 yards away to go." And he would turn into the announcer. "Quarterback goes back with the ball, hands off to Rogers. It's a geek, he's got the ball, he's going down the field." And I would see my dad as he dodged the table saw and bounced off the workbench and watched out for a drill press that was ready to attack him. And he would leap over the stack of lumber and score the winning touchdown, having danced his way through the garage. His hands were going high, the construction helmet football still in his hand, and the crowds were going wild. And I would sit there thinking to myself, "Someday, I'm going to be just like that." Well, when I started high school, I was the first in line to try out for football. There was only one problem. I was a runt. I was the scrawniest, puniest, most pee-wee wimp of a guy you could possibly imagine. I was like the paradigm example of the 90-pound weakling, except I didn't weigh 90 pounds. I wasn't even close. I made Woody Allen look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I was a runt. And when I tried out for the football team, they didn't even have equipment that would fit me. The shoulder pads just shimmied down to my waist. The thigh pads went all the way down to my ankles. The helmet would just circle around my head. It was absolutely incredible. But the football team had a place for me. I became the equipment manager, also known as the water boy. Well, I dove into my task as if the entire championship of the season was dependent upon my work, right? And I would hustle water out to these huddles, and I collected the pads, and I timed wind sprints. But still, every once in a while, I'd saddle up to the grandstands, and I'd look at those players, that big quarterback launching high bombs all the way down the field, those sleek-footed receivers making diving catches, and I'd think to myself, someday, I'm gonna be just like that. But it wasn't going to be in football. I realized early on that I had to find a sport that size did not play so much of a difference in your ability to perform it. And at least one where the uniforms fit, right? Well, I was in for a surprise. I found it posted on a locker room bulletin board. Swimming tryouts this Friday. I know how to swim, I thought. I mean, my friends and I, we do cannonballs off of Gold Street Bridge all summer long. And this is my sport, exactly. So that Friday, I walked into the locker room ready to try out for the swimming team, and I must have had sucker written right across my forehead. I went up, and there were two of these seniors in the equipment cage. And I went up to them, and I said, I'm here to try out for the swim team. And they said, freshman, aren't you? Yes, sir. He said, you need a suit, don't you? I said, I do. So he gave me a standard issue cloth suit, and I observed very quickly that this suit does not have any strings. This is the kind of suit that doesn't need strings. Okay. Being a trusting freshman, I went back and disrobed and put on the suit and wind my way out into the pool area. Well, the pool was all decked out as if it were ready for a sectional swimming meet. There were flags all over the place. There were cliques of swimmers up and down either line. The girls were all on one side and the boys were all on the other. And there, right at the corner of the swimming pool, was Coach Holman. Coach Holman was this bearded, burly man. He was kind of a cross between Santa Claus and a grizzly bear. I never knew if I should run away from him or jump up into his lap. I mean, he looked like he could either yell at you or he could just give you a hug, one at the same time. I mean, just this incredible guy. And I just kind of moved away from him, took my place, and I watched as he would name a name off the clipboard he always carried and blow a whistle, and somebody would take a dive off of the blocks, and he would direct them down these different lanes and doing different strokes and flip turns, and it was all looking like acrobatic magic to me. I mean, these great racing dives, and so I was still trying to figure out exactly how I was going to do this when he called my name. And I made my way up to those blocks and did the best impression that I could of what a racing start would look like, and he blew the whistle, and off I shot, and before I even hit the water, that swimming suit was around my ankles. Thank God for feet, or I would have shot right out of the thing. Man, humiliated, I grabbed that suit and pulled it up and tried to take a couple of sprints before anybody noticed. But before two pulls, the suit's already going down my thighs again. People are starting to point and make catcalls. So I pull it up and I hold it with one hand and I try to swim like this. But all I'm doing is swallowing water. So I think to myself, I got it, I'll do the breaststroke. So I clamp my legs together and I just did it like this. But without a kick, I ended up vertical in the water. That was barely. Until finally, I just grabbed the gold of the lane buoys and looked up at the coach, and he gave me his first words ever. Why don't you get a suit that fits? I was humiliated, embarrassed, red from head to toe, and you could tell. But I very gingerly got out of the pool and made my way towards the locker room. And once I got through the other side, I looked back through that meshed window. All the kids are still laughing until Coach Holman put an abrupt end to it by this sharp whistle. Reuben, get up here! And I watched as this slick-bodied senior got up in his skin-tight Speedo up on that block. When he blew the whistle again, he took a dive, hovered in the air, and then, without hardly a splash, entered the water, surfaced in a perfect dolphin kick, butterfly stroke on down the lane. And I thought to myself, someday I'm going to be just like that. Well, I made the swim team, only because everybody made the swim team. And I was in for the shock of my life. It happened on the first day of practice when he said, okay, everybody, 20 laps. I thought, 20 laps? This guy's trying to kill us. He's a monster. But I slapped and splashed my way up those 20 laps, and when I got done, I was surprised. I was the first one done. Everybody else was still swimming. So I started to get out of the pool, and Coach Holman comes up and says, where are you going? I said, I'm done, 20 laps. He says, that's the warm-up. Come on. I want 10 laps butterfly stroke, 10 laps breaststroke, 2 times 50 yards, go. When you're done with that, see me about the rest of the workout. I was amazed. Navy SEAL training couldn't be this bad. But I splashed my way, I gasped my way, I kicked my way up and down those laps. And when I was done, the last person to leave the pool, Coach Holman was standing at his corner, looking down at his clipboard. And as I walked by, dragging my bony body by him, he said, nice work, swimmer. Nice work. I couldn't even mutter a reply. I just went in. But I came back the next day, and the day after that. And I came back every day that season. And without fail, every practice, I was the last one finished. Heaving, spitting, swallowing water, dragging myself out of the pool. And every single day, Coach Holman was there. And he would always say, nice work, swimmer. Nice work. Well, being on the swim team also meant meets, right? It meant competing, and Coach Holman was kind enough to put me into every single meet. A different race every time. It didn't matter. I was equally bad at all of them. And I went through that entire season never finishing anything but last in my race. Sometimes it was sixth, sometimes it was eighth, depending on how many people were swimming, but it was always last. The highlight of my season was when I took a fourth place. There were only four of us swimming, but I didn't care. If there would have been only three of us, I was going to get that fourth place no matter what, you know? And when I came out of that pool, already proud that I could go home and write my dad and tell him I took a fourth place today, the first person to greet me was Coach Holman, swatting me on the butt with his clipboard and saying, nice work, swimmer. Nice work. Well, it was such a painful year that I was glad, to tell you the truth, when the whole thing was over. But I was also ready to celebrate because I endured it to the end. And on the last day of our getting together was the awards banquet. And we all got decked out, me in my rust-colored leisure suit and clip-on tie, and made our ways to sit around the tables, and it was the coolest thing because we had lots to celebrate. Our team had taken first place in state sectionals that year, winning the district and winning the regionals and winning the sectionals. And these guys were incredible. And I sat there elbow to elbow with these guys as the gold medals and the certificates and the ribbons were all being passed out. And I was thinking to myself, I was glad to be at the same school as these guys, let alone in the same room and on the same team. And at the end of the whole award ceremony, after all these guys were going and receiving their wonderful accolades, Coach Holman hushed the crowd one last time. And he said, "We've got one last award to give out today. It's the Most Inspirational Swimmer Award." And he said, "This year, we're giving this to somebody special. We're giving it to somebody who this whole year has told us what it means to have courage. We're giving it to someone who has showed us what dignity is all about. We're giving it to someone who has an incredible strength, an inner strength, a strength that is so strong that it surfaces to win any race that he participates in that is important. We're giving this award to somebody who embodies for us what it means to be a swimmer." And I sat in my chair thinking, someday I want to be just like that guy. This year's Most Inspirational Swimmer Award goes to Frank Rogers. And the entire room stood up and began to applaud, as I was absolutely dazed. Somehow I made my way up to the podium and looked out at this crowd who were clapping for me. And Coach Holman was there with his clipboard and a certificate, and he handed it out to me. Most Inspirational Swimmer Award in Calligraphy, 1973. And handwritten in the corner, "Nice work, swimmer. Nice work." And for the first time in my life, I didn't want to be somebody else. I just wanted to be me. True story from the beginning to end. True story, painfully true. Do you all know the power of someone like that? Who can see you in a better light than we can see ourselves, who's able to look into our heart and recognize the unique strengths, the unique gifts, the unique beauties that are ours and ours alone, that are aching to be birthed. And somehow, in their ability to see that in us, and their ability to treat us as if we already were that way, they're able to call us into being the people that we really are when we really are ourselves. They enable us to step into the power of what it means to be fully alive and fully ourselves. Do you know that kind of power? People in your lives, times in which you had a glimpse of who you are when you are yourself. Do you know that experience? By myself. We do. I believe that that's the way God looks at us. That God looks at us through the eyes of seeing who we really are. And God's own spirit is woven into the world, seeking to help us step into the fullness of what it means to be ourselves. Then that unique beauty and that unique giftedness. And one of the ways in which I think we are invited to practice that is to remember, in our own privacy or in any context we are, to remember the times in which we have known our life, the times in which we know that we were stepping into who we are when we are most fully ourselves, and to recognize what do we do and who are we with when we are that. And the invitation is for us to practice that, to step into that. It amazes me how little time we spend doing the things that give us the most life. Have you ever noticed that? People who say, I love more than anything to garden, to play my music, whatever. And yet I'm so busy that I'm not able to do that. We don't take that time. And yet, that's the invitation to step into our own unique giftedness and our own unique beauty. I think this is related to discernment too, right? To discerning the ways in which we are invited to step into that fullness of life. As individuals, but also in relationship with one another, our spouses and kids, parents, communities. So, where are we? Are we?
Got any more stories?
I was going to say, if nobody talks, I'm going to have to tell another story.
Well, for swimming your second year or sophomore year.
Pardon me?
Just go out for swimming your sophomore year.
You know what? I did. I swam for 4 years, joined the water polo team, and grew up. And, you know, I've never been a great swimmer, but, you know, I won some races and got a letter and, you know, but that was all secondary too, you know. The gift was that first year. But that's also probably why I came back. I wanted to be with him. He was, yeah.
Now, I've been thinking with what person up there said earlier about, you know, how we do service before we enjoy these moments where we are fully alive. I'm a school counselor, and at the end of the school, this last school year again, I saw everybody be so exhausted. You know, as you were saying that up there, I noticed, you know, I thought teaching or working with young people shouldn't be this way. You know, you can't give really when you're so exhausted all the time. Mm-hmm. And I did an awards ceremony at the end of the year that I totally enjoyed. I mean, that's the kind of thing I love to do, organizing something like that. And while I was doing that, although I was very exhausted at the end, I could just totally feel this pulse in me, and I didn't look at the clock anymore. You know, when it was time to go home, and I'd stay until 7 at night and 8 at night, 9 at night, and take it home and still try to get this thing to be just totally right. And I thought, this is how work should be, you know, this is how, you know, you have to love the things that you do.
Exercising your creative gifts and the things that you love doing and have an ability to do those, yeah. Psychologists call those flow experiences. When we experience ourselves in a flow, completely at one, I mean, just sort of lost in the moment and at the height of our powers, now that's exactly the kind of experience that they talk about. And we all experience it in different ways and doing different things and many different things. The other thing that I thought when you were saying that is there have been studies done in energy. And you know how exhausted we get, you know, at work and, you know, all of those different things. What we think the way to get that energy back is to rest. But have you ever had the experience where I just need a weekend to do nothing. And so you sit there and I do nothing. And I watch TV or whatever. And on Monday morning, you're just as exhausted as you were on Friday night. I mean, resting and doing nothing isn't the way in which energy is harnessed and retrieved. The way in which it is by doing what you're talking about. Doing those things that give you life. If you're an artist, paint. If you like being in the country, then walk. If it's exercising creative gifts, then exercise creative gifts. If it's going to movies, playing with kids, being with your spouse, making love, whatever, where you get your energy, where you lose yourself, where you feel alive, that is a way of being able to be re-energized to participate in the service of our work and with a greater sense of health. So it's healthy, not just faithful.
I don't remember where I heard this, but someone has said that if you always work from your skills, You will soon be exhausted, but if you work from your gifts, you will be renewed.
That's it, right there, in a nutshell.
Can you say that again?
Maybe not. If you always work from your skills, you will soon be exhausted. But if you work from your gifts, you will always be renewed.
Yeah.
I worked with a very energetic man who would say that when people were tired, it was because they were bored.
And how often we do things that dispirit us, that de-energize us, that we are bored when we are doing them, and maybe we shouldn't be in that work, or we should be looking for other things to energize us. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to think that God yearns for this for us. God doesn't want us to be the bored, you know, drudgery. God has given us those gifts, and we know what they are because they're the things that give us life when we are doing them. That's the thing that God yearns for us to celebrate and nurture and to develop. That's God's hopes for humanity. Not that we grit our teeth and do the things that we're supposed to do.
Why do you think that's such a transitory thing? I mean, that your image, your story is so beautiful about the swimming piece and at the end of the awards banquet. And then the same thing with your son and the lady that was so angry, and then how it was like an enrapturing moment or whatever. And the theme about being fully alive, fully human, whatever. Why is that such a transitory? Why are those just such rare moments in this life, if God wants that for us all the time?
Yeah. Well, I don't think, first of all, I don't think we can live in an energized state 24 hours a day. I mean, I don't think we are called to that at all. I mean, there's rhythms to life. But we are invited to know our powers much more fully than we do. And why do we not? I don't know. Why do we not? I mean, part of it, I wonder, is do we look for it? Are our eyes open to the faces that are all around us that are inviting us to connect with and to know? You know, the Justins in the strollers that are in all of our malls, and us taking the time to connect with that and to be reminded. I wonder if that's part of it. And also, you know, I think it's scary to step out in your creative life. Also, I think it's frightening. You know, if we took that seriously, there'd be a lot of things that might change in the way in which we live and the decisions that we make. And you know, I think there's a shadow to that too that keeps us from, you know, resists from doing that, and we need to engage that.
Thing that's related is timing, mm-hmm. which has to do with so that there's a time to do things and there's a time not to do that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a season for everything. There's a season for the rest. There's a season for creative life. There's a season for service, to be in the midst of the wounds of the world. Yeah.
I think in terms of creating a life worth living.
Hey, there you go. Great. Creating a life worth living. Yes.
I really do think we have too many excuses for not seeking it out. Mm-hmm. It's like not on my calendar right now, you know, or it's not safe enough for.
Yeah, well, it's easy to get sucked into a swirl of busyness and job deadlines and, you know, grocery store stuff and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Yeah, it's very easy to do.
Well,
I don't mean to cut. Yeah, go ahead.
We encourage one another a lot too, don't we?
That's right.
Nice job, swimmer. Mm-hmm. If he
Absolutely.
Hadn't said that to you,
Absolutely.
Would you have kept on?
No way. I mean, I don't know, but yeah. But I mean, I certainly wouldn't.
Situations
yes.
in my own life.
Yes. Being in communities that don't dispirit us, but that do help us to, is a huge part of it. I mean, an answer, I think, to you know, part of the answer to that question.
The compliments we don't give so
that's
often.
That's right. That's
right. Or we'll say something to someone else, not to the one that we notice.
Absolutely.
Good about.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Should hear it.
Absolutely. Yes. The role that we have as community members, as teachers, as ministers, and parents, and you know, we are the agents of that spirit to cultivate that. I think that's a definite call.
And that also is the source of joy.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, being energized by the way in which we can empower another person and engage in those kinds of kind, affirming acts can be another thing that absolutely, absolutely, yeah. I've got a whole collection of different, I ask my students to bring in stories of what are the different things, and there are all kinds of things. You know, there are exercising my gifts, one of them, but doing kind deeds or being affirming would be, you know, other places. I mean, we experience it in many, many different ways. Well, we have time for one story? Is that all right? Good for 5 minutes. Okay, those of you who got appointments and need to dash at 4:45, that's okay. I'm trying. But there's one story that maybe wraps up a lot of the things that we're talking about here. It's about the man who hated Christmas. There was this guy who, over the years, quite frankly, got to the point where he hated Christmas. It wasn't that he was a particularly spiritual person. He was a hard-working, depression values kind of a guy. And he was frankly getting fed up with the way Christmas was going around these days. He had been working for a whole number of years in his community, and he watched how his friend's barber shop and the pharmacy on the corner got paved over by strip malls right down Main Street. He watched as his favorite hobby shop got paved over and became a Walmart, driving out of business his own appliance store, forcing him into early retirement. He watched as people began to get more consumeristic, how the commercials began to move ever closer to Thanksgiving, how people were just becoming greedy in Christmas, and he couldn't stand it anymore. And so come around November, when all of the stuff started, he would start his diatribe saying, you know, when I was young, Christmas used to be about giving, and now it's just about getting. People want to get what their presents, they want to get to the malls, they want to get to the sales, they want to get something over to their boss, they want to get nice presents. I am sick and tired of it. I don't want to get a thing for Christmas until people get what it's all about. This year, I want nothing. Well, his wife, long-suffering wife of many years, was beginning to worry about this guy. She was worried partly because he was beginning his retirement. And she didn't want to see him just waste away in recliner passivity watching daytime TV all the days, right? She was also kind of worried about the relationship she had with him and how that was going to shift in the midst of this new era of their lives. But mostly, she was worried that he was going to become crusted over and hardened, and that the deeply caring person she knew to be inside was not going to be able to come out. And of all times of the year that there ought to be a way to bring that out, it ought to be Christmas. One year, she got a great idea for Christmas. It happened, the idea came to her when they were visiting their grandson's wrestling match. The grandson came from a rather wealthy school, and they had all the bright colored uniforms and helmets and knee pads and the rest. But there was this team from the inner city that was dressed in rags. I mean, that just did not have any equipment. And they got beat every single match they were in. And they would jump up with this false bravado. But we watched him, he said, you know, I wish those guys at least had helmets, something that they had dignity about. I mean, they're smiling and cocky now, but the spirit is going to be taken right from them when they lose every single match they're in. That Christmas, the mother, Nan, came up with a great idea for a present. And on Christmas morning, after all the kids and grandkids opened up the presents, she made an announcement, oh, there's one more gift. It's for you, Mike. I thought I said I didn't want to get anything this year. Well, open it, you might like it. It was an envelope, and it was tucked away on the branches. And he fingered it open and pulled out an index card with typewriting on it from a Smith Corona, and it was Nan's typing. And it was a pledge that said that she was going to use her seamstress skills to make uniforms for that inner city wrestling team this year. Well, at least it's not peanut brittle. Well, sure enough, beginning of January, the tree was down and the relatives had left. She pulled out her sewing machine and set up a sewing station in the den, and she began to make out sketches for these wrestling uniforms.
And he moseyed on over and looked at him and finally said, that's not right at all. Those aren't even the right colors. And a uniform doesn't look like that. And how are you going to get the sizes right if you haven't measured the kids? And you obviously are going to need my help. And she said, well, I was wondering about if you might be willing to help me. And before you knew it, he was down at the high, at the school measuring these kids, sizing uniforms at the fabric store, buying the fabric, even on his hands and knees in the den, sticking out the different uniform pieces and with his tape measure and the whole bit. And over the course of the year, the two of them absolutely had a blast making these uniforms, taking them to these kids, becoming the grandparent guardians of this team, chaperoning away wrestling matches, absolutely having a blast. It got to the point where when the next Christmas rolled around, Mike was kind of hovering around the tree, giving off hints, I wonder if there's going to be anything for me this year. And the next year, there was another envelope. The last thing opened for Christmas morning. And this envelope was a commitment to work with the kids to build birdhouses in the nearby park. And there was a project that took them throughout the whole year. And every year thereafter, there was always an envelope. One time it was working with abused kids' home, having bottle drives and car washes to help them develop money to build a playground on their uniform. One year they took on City Hall. They gathered a whole bunch of kids, would-be social activists, and they protested a zoning decision and decided to convert a vacant lot into a community garden. It was the hit of the year. Every year, this Christmas envelope and a project that would unite them throughout the course of the year. And Nan said, you know, those were the best years of our lives. Well, one year, 3 days before Christmas, Mike had a heart attack and he died. And Christmas was going to be very different. What was going to be a quiet one turned out to be an occasion for all the family to come for a Christmas Eve funeral. Aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews, all the kids and the grandkids, they all showed up on Christmas Eve, went to the funeral, came back to the house. All day long, Nan busied herself, cooking and making sure people had things and getting towels out and the whole bit, on until late at night when it was just her and her oldest daughter up. And she said, go ahead and go to bed, honey. There's a few things I still want to do tonight. Are you sure, Mom? Yeah, I'm sure. And the daughter went to bed. And Nan put a couple of dishes away. And then she sat down on the easy chair. And there in that side table, she opened up a drawer. And there was another envelope. She had done it a couple weeks before. And she put the envelope on the branch. And she said, Mike, this is for you. And in the Christmas Eve silence, she went to bed. When she woke up, the giggles of the grandkids, the excitement around the tree was coming into her bedroom. She had slept in a little bit more than she had planned to, and she put on her robe and got on her slippers and opened her door and started to walk out into the living room. And everybody turned and said good morning to her, and then she looked at everybody, and then she looked towards the Christmas tree, and she stopped. Because there on the Christmas tree was her envelope, and dozens of other white envelopes all around the tree. Every one of the people there, nephew, niece, child, and grandchild, took out an envelope and made a commitment of some project, some act of care, some service that they were going to do in the coming year in the memory and the love of the grandfather. And Nan said, you know, it made Christmas just a little bit easier that year to think of all the trees and all the envelopes that are going to stretch out through all the future Christmases and all the projects that will make their way throughout this world in memory of this one beautiful man.
What does it mean to be fully alive? To care, to be in relationship, to know that life that cannot be contained. It's going to spill out. It's going to ripple its way throughout our world. And the hope is that as we step into the fullness of our lives, we will find ourselves dancing with that spirit that is healing our world. And we are all invited to the dance. Amen.